Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our job here, as always, is taking this big pile of sources, articles, notes, research, and basically giving you the ultimate shortcut to getting up to speed. Today, we are doing a deep dive into someone who, well, he really embodies professional chaos and maybe radical authenticity. We're talking about Eddie Huang.
Yeah, it's fascinating. If you just like looked at the list of jobs Eddie Huang has had, you'd probably think you were looking at maybe three or four completely different people's careers. I mean, the journey starts in, you know, the super structured world of corporate law. Then it kind of detours through stand-up comedy, some what's called illicit business, finds huge success as a chef and author. And then he turns right around and uses that very success as fuel for some really pointed cultural critique. It's quite a ride.
It really is. The guy has successfully navigated fields that for most people are just completely separate worlds. Corporate lawyer, then stand-up comic, then a marijuana dealer, then a critically acclaimed chef, a best-selling author, and a film director. It's honestly kind of baffling how he pulls it off, how he exists at the intersection of all these things.
And that's really our mission today, isn't it? We're digging through all this material, not just to like list his accomplishments, but to really try and understand the blueprint, if there is one. How does someone pivot so dramatically between these really high-stakes, formal environments, think the Innocence Project, and then disruptive entrepreneurship, all while cultivating this incredibly outspoken, often, you know, pretty controversial public persona?
Yeah, exactly. And for you listening, this deep dive is almost like a masterclass in how you maintain some sense of identity while your professional life is just radically changing all the time.
Yeah.
We really need to figure out what the constant is, you know, in a career that seems defined by constant variables. So let's unpack that foundation, that sort of contradictory beginning that made it all possible. Hashtag IIRD life, education, and the contradictory foundation. Okay, so the sources, right away, they throw you into this world of duality. Eddie Huang, born Edwin Charles Huang in Fairfax, Virginia, back in 1982. His history just seems defined by this extreme academic achievement happening right alongside some pretty significant personal conflict.
Yeah, you absolutely have to start with the family background. His parents, Jessica and Louis Huang, they were Taiwanese immigrants, and the sources specifically note they were Weishengrin. Now, for anyone listening who might not know, that's a specific term. It refers to families who moved from mainland China to Taiwan around the time of the Chinese Civil War following the KMT. So his father's family was originally from Hunan. His mother's from Shandong on the mainland. This isn't just a generic immigrant story. There's a layer of specific history, maybe even displacement baked in there.
Right. That context is important. And this family history, it also sets up the business side of things, right? He grew up first in Silver Spring, Maryland, then Orlando, Florida, and his dad owns successful restaurants there, places like Atlantic Bay Seafood and Grill, Cattleman's Ranch, Steakhouse, yeah. Big operations.
That restaurant background is absolutely crucial. You can't overstate it. He was immersed, really young, in that intense, high-pressure world of the service industry, you know, a world where organization, keeping your cool, it's constantly tested. But at the same time, there was this personal chaos going on. The sources mention he was frequently getting into fights, apparently resulting in at least two arrests for assault charges when he was younger.
So you've got this volatility happening, maybe at home, definitely in his personal life, but the academic track is just moving along, seemingly untouched by all that conflict. What about cultural influences? That seems key too.
Oh, absolutely key. That's really where his later persona starts to form. He developed this really deep appreciation for African-American culture, especially hip-hop, from a really young age. And this wasn't just like casual listening. The sources suggest this was a deep cultural identification, something outside the sort of traditional expectations maybe placed on an Asian American kid back then. And that unconventionality, that interest, it definitely fueled the style and the critique that would later define his writing and his whole public career. It was like his first major pivot away from some kind of prescribed identity.
And yet, look at how well he did within the system, the mainstream institutional system. Dr. Phillips High School in Orlando, then College, University of Pittsburgh, and Rollins College. He graduated from Rollins in 2004, BA in English and Film. Pretty standard success track, right?
No, more than standard. This is where you see the, let's call it, the structural ability really kicking in. He wasn't just getting by, he was winning awards. At Rollins, he snagged the Barbara Lawrence Alphon English Award and the Zora Neale Hurston Award. That's a big deal. Plus, he was the sports and humor editor for the school paper, the Sand Spur. So you see this intense focus on literature, communication, critical thinking, all that stuff.
Okay, and then the ultimate move towards the establishment. law school. He gets his JD from Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University in 2008.
And look at the work he did during law school. It shows, I mean, serious intellectual horsepower and a real desire to engage with systems of power, maybe even challenge them. He worked at the Innocence Project. For those listening, that's the organization dedicated to exonerating wrongly convicted people, often using DNA testing and pushing for criminal justice reform. That's a highly analytical field, right? Emotionally demanding too, and it's all centered on exposing systemic failure.
That detail about the Innocence Project feels huge. It shows he understands how to critique institutions from the inside, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And beyond that, he was really involved in student groups. President of the Minority Law Students Association, Vice President of the Asian Pacific American Law Students Association. He even won a New York City Bar Association Minority Fellowship in 2006. I mean, this guy was perfectly positioned for traditional institutional success.
The contrast is just, it's kind of stunning. The young guy with assault arrests deep into hip hop culture is also operating at this super high level of legal prep, focusing on things like criminal justice reform.
And that, I think, is the essential takeaway from these foundational years. You've got the legal expertise, that capacity for deep research, for structure, for aggressive argument, providing the intellectual framework. Then you've got the conflict, the restaurant background, the cultural immersion, providing the, well, the raw, unpredictable material. This duality meant he was kind of equipped to win within the system, but also maybe culturally programmed to tear that system down if he felt it was necessary.
Okay, so the foundation's set. He's got the JD, the fellowships, the structure. He hits what most would see as the peak of early conventional success. Landing a job as a corporate attorney, Chadbourne and Park in New York City. Started as an associate in 2008. This is high stakes, big firm law, requires serious conformity.
Exactly. Corporate law at a firm like that. It's a world of complex contracts, mergers, high finance. It's incredibly demanding, requires basically 24/7 dedication to that structure. But then the very system he'd trained so hard to conquer basically failed him. The 2008 financial crisis hit hard.
Yeah.
And bam, he was laid off within a year.
Wow. That must have felt like everything he'd worked for just got erased. Years of academic grind gone because of a global economic meltdown.
Totally. And his reaction to that institutional failure wasn't, you know, try to find another law job. It was a hard swerve into the completely unconventional. The sources say right after the layoff, he briefly worked as a stand-up comic. And then here's that radical dissonance again as a marijuana dealer.
Okay, I can kind of see the connection to the conflict. The need for material, maybe for comedy, but stand-up and dealing. Were those serious paths, or was the pivot to food already kind of brewing, does the sources say?
The sources frame it more as a reactive phase, almost like survival mode. Stand up, dealing, they provided cash, maybe some stories, but the underlying ambition always seemed entrepreneurial, which, you know, links right back to his family background. Even before food took off, he tested the waters in fashion. Ran a streetwear company called Hoodman Clothing, originally Bergdorf Hoodman from about 2006 to 2009, co-creating designs with Ning Wang. So an early sign of mixing cultural commentary with, like, retail.
But the real professional identity he carved out was definitely in the kitchen. He had the family training, obviously, but no formal culinary school.
Nope. His education there was totally organic. Learned cooking from his mom, picked up techniques, and crucially, management skills from watching and working with chefs in his dad's restaurants. He specifically credits his dad with teaching him how to be a really good expediter.
Right, the expediter.
Yeah.
For anyone listening who doesn't know the kitchen lingo, that's the person who basically organizes and times all the orders. The crucial link between the kitchen line and the servers. It's pure organizational skill under pressure.
Exactly. It's basically the lawyer brain applied to the chaos of a busy kitchen. He took those high-pressure organizational skills home during his JD, learned in his youth, and applied them to his own vision. And it paid off pretty quick. Chow.com named him to their Chow 13 list in 2011, basically a list of influential people in food.
And then came Bauhaus.
Bauhaus. Open December 2009, Lower East Side.
Yeah.
Focused on those Taiwanese guabao, the steamed buns. And it was a huge hit immediately. It got tons of media attention. People loved the unique food. It was affordable. It eventually moved to a bigger spot on East 14th Street in 2011. Bauhaus was like his focused, well-executed success story.
But then we hit that sharp contrast again. Bauhaus is flying high, and then there's the rapid, kind of spectacular failure of Xiao Ye.
Right, Xiao Ye, his second restaurant venture. And yeah, it failed fast, poor reviews, plus that controversy over selling Four Loko, which was a whole thing back then. The sources give us this just stunning detail. Sam Sifton, the critic for the New York Times at the time, awarded Xiaoye 0 stars out of 4. 0.
Yeah, char stars from the Times. That's absolutely brutal for a new restaurant in New York.
Devastating. But the critique itself, what Sifton wrote, might be the most telling part of this whole chapter. He didn't just slam the food. He criticized Huang's focus. He wrote something like, if Huang spent even a third of the time cooking that he does, writing funny blog posts and wry Twitter updates, posting hip-hop videos and responding to internet folks, Xiaoye might actually have been interesting.
Wow. So Sifton's take was essentially that the public persona, the very thing making the brand, drawing people in, was actively undermining the actual restaurant, the execution in the kitchen.
It's the perfect synthesis of that dual nature we talked about earlier, right? His, like, irresistible urge for public engagement, for provocation, which fueled the successful blog and built his identity. It got ahead of the practical, structured execution needed for Xiaoye. It really shows how radical authenticity can be a powerful marketing tool, absolutely. But if it distracts too much from the core product, well, the business itself can just collapse. Hashtag 3, the author, the show, and the public conflict.
Okay, so the blogging. The public persona, despite the Xiaoye crash, that actually leads to his biggest cultural moment yet. The memoir. He takes his blog, fresh off the boat, turns it into a book. Random House publishes it in 2013. Gets great reviews, Publishers Weekly, The New York Times. Becomes a bestseller.
Yeah, that transition felt pretty natural, actually. He clearly had the writing chops. I remember those English awards back at Rollins. And he had this incredible, explosive material from his own contradictory life. He really cemented himself as a cultural commentator with that book. Followed it up, too, with Double Cup Love in 2016 about family, food, China.
And even before the sitcom hit, he was already on TV quite a bit. Yeah. Hosting shows like Cheap Bites, Unique Eats for the Cooking Channel. He developed that Viceland segment, also called Fresh Off the Boat, into the hour-long show Huang's World, explored food and culture globally, and then, maybe the most surprising one, Snack Off on MTV in 2014, where he's mentoring contestants making weird stuff with, like, fish sticks and canned oysters.
Hold on, Snack Off on MTV, how does that fit? You've got the corporate lawyer background, the acclaimed memoir, then judging a snack food competition.
Huh. Well, maybe it fits the pattern. You know, embracing the absurd, the high energy, maybe even the low brow end of culture, while still having this literary intellectual thing going on, building the brand everywhere, I guess.
Yeah.
But the moment that really catapulted him into a different stratosphere of public identity was ABC ordering the sitcom based on his memoir in 2014.
That was huge. A landmark moment, really. Debuted February 2015. First Asian American family sitcom on a major network in, what, decades? Stars Randall Park, Constance Wu, Hudson Yang as young Eddie. Instant cultural significance.
Yeah, massive significance. And yet, the guy whose life it was supposedly based on became its loudest critic. The sources say he was outspoken in his criticism of how it was developed.
He didn't just, like, quietly disagree and walk away. No, he wrote this long, really scathing essay about it. That's where he famously coined the term bamboo ceiling TV.
Mm-hmm.
And that concept was central to his whole critique, basically, that the show was engineered for success by, well, sanitizing the messy, complex reality of the immigrant experience, making it palatable, easy to digest for a broad, mainstream, probably mostly white network audience.
So what specific compromises was he seeing? What did the network want that rubbed him the wrong way?
The sources suggest he felt the show just strayed too far from the raw, sometimes painful stuff in his memoir. You know, the reality of being an immigrant kid, the socioeconomic struggles his family faced. He felt it got transformed into a more generic, kind of aspirational, middle-class family comedy. That the structure of network TV itself, needing neat narratives, predictable conflicts, feel-good endings, just erased the abrasive truth he'd written about.
He did narrate the first season, right?
Yeah.
But then left entirely before season 2 started.
Yep. And he made it incredibly clear he doesn't like the show. Said it was because the storyline, after the pilot, just went way off course from his actual memoir. I mean, think about that. It's almost unheard of publicly trashing the adaptation of your own life story, especially one that's commercially successful.
Did he ever, like, watch it again after leaving? There were hundreds of episodes eventually.
According to the sources, only 2 times. He watched an episode with a DMX cameo, which, surprisingly, he kind of liked. Said it reflected some interactions he wrote about in Double Cup Love, showing a different side of his life. The other time, he apparently tuned in briefly when the family visited Taiwan in an episode, and he immediately disliked it. Said it felt totally inauthentic.
This is really the core of his public persona, isn't it? He sacrificed this potentially massive ongoing commercial win, one that definitely solidified his fame, just to maintain the integrity of his cultural critique.
It's the ultimate refusal to conform, maybe. He leveraged his life story to get exposure, get capital, sure. But he drew this incredibly hard line when institutions tried to shape that story for him. Rejecting in the sitcom was this really high-profile declaration that, for him, cultural representation, if it's compromised, is basically worthless, even if it brings fame and money. Hashtag tag 5E. The provocateur and cultural appropriation controversies.
Okay, so that dedication to being uncompromising, radically authentic, it often tips over into just pure provocation, doesn't it?
Mm.
Especially around race and culture. Which brings us to the controversies that have definitely followed him.
Yeah, we definitely have to talk about the backlash he got after comments he made on Real Time with Bill Maher back in May 2015. This is really where his outspoken style collided with some very complex intersectional criticism.
Right. He made that really polarizing statement. He said, I feel like Asian men have been emasculated so much in America that we're basically treated like black women.
And that comment immediately drew huge criticism. And, you know, arguably rightly so. The main critique was that it seemed to erase the very specific history, struggles, and identity of black women, led to accusations of misogynoir, that dangerous mix of misogyny and anti-blackness. It highlighted this tricky thing. Even if Hwang was critiquing white power structures, people felt he was doing it by stepping on another marginalized group.
And the whole thing blew up more on Twitter, right? Where his attempt to defend himself kind of went sideways fast.
Yeah, exactly. He got into it with a critic who was challenging his statement. And instead of engaging with the substance of the critique, he sort of deflected by trying to make it personal, almost flirtatious. Said something like, "Are we dating? I cause you wild in a lol." It came across as a really dismissive, maybe even misogynistic way to shut down serious criticism. Just fueled the fire.
Which connects maybe to the other major critique people have had.
Mm-hmm.
The whole cultural appropriation issue.
Mm.
Especially regarding African-American culture, which, as we said, he's deeply appreciated since he was young.
Right. Joshua David Stein, writing for the New York Times, kind of summed it up pretty sharply. Described Hwang as a walking mixtape of postmodern cultural appropriation. It's a memorable line.
It is, yeah. But it's also complicated, right? Because, as the sources point out, Asian Americans have been part of hip-hop culture for a long time. They mention Fresh Kid Ice from 2 Live Crew as an early example.
That historical context is definitely important. Hwang isn't the first Asian American involved in hip-hop, not by a long shot. But Brian Hayo, writing in New Bloom magazine, tried to pinpoint why Hwang's specific adoption of that persona caused friction. Hayo pointed to Hwang's, quote, misogynistic language and attitudes, his non-conventional English speech and dress, his stories about run-ins with police suggesting it was all part of this consciously adopted hip-hop-influenced persona. So the core issue for critics wasn't necessarily the influence itself, but how that persona, especially the language, was used, particularly when he was pushing back against critics on issues of gender and race, like in the Bill Maher fallout.
So it's less about the appreciation, maybe, and more about the way he used that cultural vocabulary, combined with maybe his privileged background, his legal training, that argumentative style that created the friction.
I think that's a good way to put it. When challenged, Hwang himself offered a defense. He said something like, "I've devoted myself to speaking about people owning their own cultures, educating people about the foundational values and culture." He sees his work as defending cultural ownership.
But it seems like the risk of being so radically authentic, so provocative, is that when you push boundaries that aggressively, you eventually become the target of the same kind of scrutiny you apply to others.
Exactly. That legal structure gave him the tools and maybe the confidence to argue his points forcefully. The cultural vocabulary gave him a framework, but blending them sometimes meant he, perhaps unintentionally, bulldozed over certain nuances, especially intersectional ones, and that led to significant backlash.
It really proves that maintaining that kind of authenticity is like navigating a minefield. His whole career feels like a living experiment in how far you can push a super personalized, provocative cultural identity before maybe that identity starts to overshadow the message itself. Hashtag V film directing and recent public drama, 2019-2025. Okay, so given his whole history of rejecting institutional control, maybe it makes perfect sense that his next big move was into film directing. A field where he could potentially seize complete control over the narrative. In 2019, it was announced he'd write and direct Boogie.
Yeah, Boogie felt like a really significant step. It's a coming-of-age story, focuses on a young Chinese-American basketball hopeful had Taylor Takahashi, Pamela Chi, and the rapper Pop Smoke in his acting debut, actually. This really let Hwang weave together all those recurring themes from his life: basketball, feeling like an outsider as a minority, dealing with domestic conflict, but this time without a network filter telling him what he could or couldn't show.
And what really stands out about this film, kind of reflecting his intense, maybe impulsive creative style, is how fast he apparently wrote it. Sources say he wrote the entire screenplay in just 5 days. No plan, no outline.
5 days. That's almost like a manic burst of creativity, isn't it? It really reflects that sheer force of personality that seems to drive everything he does. Directing basically let him take all the material that maybe ABC had sanitized and just present it raw, completely on his own terms. He's kept doing that kind of work, too. Directed a documentary in 2025 called Vice is Broke.
But his tendency to engage directly with conflict, that core part of his public persona, it didn't just disappear when he stepped behind the camera. It just seems to have shifted to the most local, intensely personal stage possible, his own NYC apartment building. We kind of have to talk about the Matt Sauerhoff incident from February 2025.
Oh, yeah. That incident feels like a perfect, almost textbook example of the Hwang playbook in action, just on a micro level. Identify something you see as unjust, expose what you feel is institutional hypocrisy, and then use your public platform to demand accountability. So Matt Sauerhoff was his neighbor, a fitness trainer, apparently a former actor.
And the whole thing started outside, right? Hwang and his dog were supposedly sitting on a bench, and Sauerhoff's unleashed dog allegedly knocked them off. And, you know, New York City law is pretty clear. Dogs have to be leashed in public.
Right. So when Hwang apparently politely asked Sauerhoff to leash his dog, the situation just blew up. Sauerhoff allegedly refused, got really angry. The sources describe Sauerhoff going on this long tirade, yelling abuse, swearing, all inside the lobby of their building, and Hwang filmed it.
And then Sauerhoff tried to use the building's own system against Hwang, right? Falsely accused Hwang of trespassing in their shared lobby, even though Hwang lived there, tried to get him thrown out.
That's the key moment, isn't it? It's like pattern recognition. It's the small-scale version of the TV network trying to tell him his story doesn't fit their narrative, that he doesn't belong. And Hwang, you know, the guy who worked at the Innocence Project, who built a career calling out what he sees as BS, he instantly recognized that move.
And the attempt to intimidate him didn't stop there.
Yeah.
It escalated to Sauerhoff's family getting involved.
Yeah, Sauerhoff's mother-in-law, Dahlia Krinsky, apparently confronted Hwang later, tried to pressure him not to pursue charges by saying her husband, Barry H. Krinsky, was a superior court judge, which it turns out wasn't even true. He was an attorney, not a judge.
Wow. So they tried to weaponize perceived social status, maybe judicial power, even if it was exaggerated or just plain false, to shut down a complaint about an off-leash dog.
It's basically institutional maneuvering, just at the most hyper-local level imaginable. And Hwang, true to form, what does he do? He posts the video, reports the off-leash violation, demands an apology. And the sources say Sauerhoff ended up quitting social media because of the huge public backlash that Hwang effectively orchestrated using his platform.
It seems almost strange for a public figure of his level to get so deeply involved in a neighbor dispute. But why is this hyperlocal drama actually relevant? Why should you, the listener, care about a dog incident?
Because I think it perfectly frames his entire career thesis in a way.
Yeah.
Hwang seems defined by this refusal to let power, whether it's corporate power, network power, perceived family status, or even just neighborly entitlement, operate unchecked. He leverages his fame not just to promote himself, but as a tool, almost like a weapon, to demand accountability. Whether the injustice is something huge and national, like how immigrant stories get told, or something seemingly minor, like a neighbor breaking leash laws and then trying to bully him about it. It's the same pattern of resistance. Hashtag tag outro.
So when you step back, we've really tracked a singular path, haven't we? The Innocence Project associate, who becomes a marijuana dealer. The acclaimed chef, whose own hype maybe sabotaged his second restaurant. The best-selling author who then publicly rejects the TV show based on his own life while it's still running, and the cultural provocateur who uses everything, his film work, his personal drama, to champion this idea of uncompromising truth.
It really is the ultimate summary of paradox, isn't it? Hwang seems to embody these simultaneous, often contradictory identities. His success isn't built on being consistent within one industry. It seems built on the consistency of his critique across every industry he touches. He treats each field, law, food, books, movies, almost like a vehicle to push forward his personal narrative and his cultural observations. They're all just platforms for the same core project.
So if you're listening and thinking about your own career, your own identity shifts, what's the core lesson here?
I think it's about the power, but also the profound complication of trying to maintain radical authenticity across different professional fields. Huang's success, arguably, doesn't come from letting a law firm or ABC or anyone else define him. It seems to come from his relentless ability to define himself, even when that means sacrificing potential profit or widespread popularity. He sort of demonstrated that defining yourself might be the most valuable currency you have, but man, it comes with a really high price tag sometimes.
And that cost, that's really our final provocative thought for you today. Think about the intense risk, but also the potential reward. When a public figure chooses to expose the compromises that often come with commercial success. From turning down the easy money of a network sitcom based on his life, to calling out a neighbor over, let's face it, a relatively minor infraction, but a principle he believed in. Huang seems willing to put everything on the line to completely own his story. So what does it truly cost to maintain that level of uncompromising truth, especially when faced with the allure of mass appeal? And is that cost even sustainable over the long haul of a career? It's a huge question, and it really feels like it defines Eddie Huang's entire blueprint.